the Richard Nixon Experience.
It's been another big day for historians. More of the Nixon tapes have been released. This time, the National Archives has made available the transcripts from 60 hours of tape recordings made in the Oval Office by Richard Nixon and others when Mr. Nixon was president. Many of the tapes have not been made public before. Here's ABC's John Martin.
The tapes in this National Archives facility offer the first full account in their own words of Nixon White House officials desperate to cover up the story of the break-in at Democratic headquarters. 6 days after the burglars were arrested, the transcripts show clearly, Nixon seemed not to have known in advance about it. Nixon to Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman. This involves these Cubans, Hunt, and a lot of hanky-panky that we have nothing to do with ourselves. What the hell? Did Mitchell know about this thing? Nixon and his aides believed campaign director John Mitchell had ordered an intelligence operation and that G. Gordon Liddy had carried it out, but had gone much further than expected. Nixon, is it Liddy? Is that the fellow? He must be a little nuts. He just isn't well screwed on, is he? Haldeman, but he was under pressure to get more information. And as he got more pressure, Nixon, from Mitchell? Haldeman, apparently. Haldeman said the FBI investigation was out of control. Haldeman, Mitchell's recommendation is to have the CIA tell the FBI, stay the hell out of this. Nixon, all right, fine. Former Deputy CIA Director Vernon Walters admitted in his memoirs that he carried out the mission for the White House. But even today, the words provoked denial. Former CIA Director Richard Helms told ABC News, we declined to do it. We did nothing. 13 members of the Nixon White House and campaign staff went to prison for the break-in and the cover-up. Today, a Nixon aide said the former president is writing a book about the future and has no comment about the past. John Martin, ABC News, Washington.
In the great division of views of Watergate, everybody agrees there was an illegal break-in. Everybody agrees there was an illegal cover-up trying to protect people that knew about the break-in. The diversion is a disagreement over who knew and what the cover-up was designed to protect. The attackers of the president believe the president and his top staff knew or should have known about all this. The president's defenders beg to differ and say it all comes down to John Dean as the centerpiece. He recruited and hired Gordon Liddy. He was at these two key meetings where the plan was presented, and when the people were arrested, caught red-handed in the DNC headquarters, John Dean was at risk of prosecution and knew it. So he led the cover-up not to protect President Nixon, but to cover his own tail. And when it came apart, when it all blew up, and it should have blown up, it was an illegal cover-up, John Dean switched sides and his story and said, I'll testify against my superiors if you let me go. And that's what happened.
I have a copy of a memo, which was one of dozens of such memos sent to me, and there's an item in here that says the Attorney General discussed with John Dean the need to develop a political intelligence capability. John Dean did, in fact, move himself pretty much into the whole area of political intelligence.
John Mitchell was highly respected by President Nixon. He was a law partner in Nixon Mudrow's law firm. In New York when Nixon was there. He was head of the Nixon 1968 election campaign. Nixon had lost in 1960 and ran his own campaign. In 68, they convinced Nixon just give that over and let Mitchell run it. Mitchell was a bond lawyer, and he's very famous for inventing the moral obligation bond. In most municipalities and states, before the government can incur debt, dedicate future tax collections to a project, they need a vote of the people. And damn, sometimes those people just won't go along with new debt. So what Mitchell invented was called the moral obligation bond. They don't, the municipality doesn't guarantee we'll pay this bond, but we'll act like we do, so that you didn't have to have a vote of the people. And he became very successful. His firm's opinions on all these bond issues was absolutely key to incurring debt without a vote. He was highly respected by Nixon. When Nixon won, he asked John Mitchell to be his attorney general. Mitchell didn't want to come. He wasn't a political guy. He was having troubles with his wife. The famous Martha, who was...
Not famous to our audience, but she will be.
She will become very famous. She is well on her way to becoming an alcoholic. He loves her dearly, but she is a handful, and he doesn't want to come.
So they moved from New York to Washington, D.C.
Yes, and take an apartment at the Watergate apartment complex.
You anticipated my question. So John Mitchell and Martha Mitchell are living at the Watergate. He's the attorney general. These are controversial times. These are turbulent times. Can you reflect a little bit on what Washington in 1969 when you arrived, 1970 when you moved to the White House, is like, what the mobilization about against the war makes it like, and the tension of the era?
The Vietnam War is the most unpopular war in the nation's history. Just massive upset. Kids don't want to be drafted. I was part of the era where you just believed, as the night the day, if you got drafted, you were going to Vietnam. If you went to Vietnam, you were going to die.
Why weren't you drafted?
Because I joined ROTC at Harvard Law School. I was terrified I'd be drafted out of law school. The college, Whittier, being a Quaker college, didn't have ROTC units. So it was open, shut, you were going to go. You're going to go some way. So I joined ROTC at Harvard.
Okay, so back to D.C. in 1970.
Yeah. So the nation is tearing itself apart, and the Department of Justice is in the middle of it. And John Mitchell comes to Washington to head it. He was the Department of Justice, highly respected. Career officials at the Department of Justice were in awe of John Mitchell. He wasn't a political hack. The head of the criminal division, Henry Peterson, who had served 12 attorneys general, said he thought Mitchell never uttered a single word he didn't intend to. No chit-chat, no casual. You run a meeting. The meeting is run in an appropriate way. A decision is made. Highly respected.
I worked for two attorney general, William French Smith and yes. Edwin Meese.
Yes.
I believe Mitchell is in the William French Smith mold originally, that he was understood to be a white shoe lawyer of extraordinary capacity
yes.
and not born for the political fray.
Absolutely. Not political at all, except this neat way of avoiding a vote. I mean, he knew state and local people all over the nation because of the bond issues, but he was not... He wasn't a political guy. Now, when it came time for the president to run for re-election, they wanted Mitchell to go back and run the re-election campaign. And what's a very interesting phenomenon that happens, Hugh, once you get into power, it's more fun being in power than it is to go back and run the campaign. And everybody postpones going back to the campaign, and they put underlings there as seat warmers. And so Mitchell didn't go. I kept putting it off and putting it off. He didn't go till March 1st of 1973. And they
72. March 1st of 1972. The election is in 1972.
I'm sorry. Yeah, absolutely true. So I get the years mixed up.
He waits until the election year
to go
over.
Well, they've been there for 5 or 6 months.
Yeah. Now, stop for a moment and talk a little bit about Mitchell as Attorney General, because I want to make perfectly clear... using a President Nixon
yes,
phrase.
Yes, one thing perfectly
one
clear.
One thing perfectly clear. He had nothing to do with the plumbers. And I want people to understand that.
Yes.
And if I'm wrong, correct me. As you know, I am not a Watergate savant. I know a little bit about Watergate. In my years with President Nixon, we were always looking forward, never backwards,
yeah.
writing books about the future, writing books
sure.
about foreign policy,
sure.
not writing books about Watergate. So when I'm wrong, just tell me I'm wrong. But it's my clear understanding that the plumbers have nothing to do with John Mitchell.
Yes, we can talk about the plumbers.
We will.
John's name won't come up.
And so at the Department of Justice, though, he is facing law and order problems, riots. He is facing massive mobilization against the war. Famous photograph of him looking down at the
tear gas.
Anti-war tear gas in front of him.
I heard President Nixon once say that You got to take care of the small things before they become a big thing. And once you see clearly happening, as we're bringing you up to date on Watergate, is the big players, the decision makers, the people who should be minding the store, are busy doing all the other things that come with being president of the United States. I mean, they're getting China open. They're working with the Soviets with detente. The Attorney General is cracking down on organized crime and desegregating the schools. And they're doing the business of running the government. And they've put underlings in and people just to get the campaign kind of going before they move over there. And that is what leads to the situation that unfolds.
John Dean said, the best way I could serve the president in 1972, the campaign year, would be to be the political intelligence chieftain. What he wanted was a full political intelligence plan.
The White House. Liddy was in the office, and I said something as an aside that wouldn't it be good if we could get rid of Jack Anderson?
He emerged from the office. He brushed by me and he said, Jeb just told me to take care of Jack Anderson.
He said, what's that? I said, I am to kill Jack Anderson. I am on my way to kill Jack Anderson. He said, oh my God. He took off like a deer running down the hall.
I then went into Magruder's office and I said, Jeb, did you just tell him to rub out Jack Anderson?
He came back in and I said, Gordon, I was just talking off the cuff. I wasn't serious. And Liddy looked at me with that stern, you know, sort of macho look. And he said, never give me an order for a hit job that you don't mean, because I'll do it.
You know, when you hear that story, you do have to wonder whose idea it was not to get rid of this guy. I shake my head at it. But again, the big guys making the real decisions who are, or you know, they're not there, so they're not minding the store. But somehow or another, Liddy stays, and they now are going to ask him to do the intelligence operation, and they ratchet up what they're doing.
I said, well, if you're talking about an all-out, full offensive and defensive capability political intelligence operation, you're talking about one hell of a lot of money, first of all. And he said, how about $500,000 for openers? And I said, well, you're in the ballpark there.
Gordon had with him these very expensive, well-done charts. I think there were seven of them. Each had different code names. And each one described some type of activity that would, in a sense, harass the Democrats.
Each different kind of operation was given the name of a precious jewel. We had so many operations, we quickly ran out of precious jewels. We went into semi-precious jewels, and by the time we were finished, we were down to coal and brick.
He said, clearly one of the major problems of this campaign is going to be the problem of demonstrations. And he said, I think, General, as he told John Mitchell, we have a good solution to that. I have retained the services of some really tough men. What I can do is direct these men to kidnap campaign leaders, drug them, and take them below the Mexican border and put them out of commission.
Mr. Mitchell said, well, where do you get people like that? And I said, it's my understanding they're from organized crime. And he said, well, what is that going to cost us?
I think for Mitchell, Dean, and I, it was rather ludicrous. Here we were, in a sense, sitting in the Attorney General of the United States office, and here's Gordon Liddy talking about some of the more bizarre plans.
He said, I've made some preliminary arrangements to get a Chinese motifed houseboat that I can park on one of the canals down near the convention center in Miami. And it will have two-way cameras in this Chinese motifed houseboat. And I'll use prostitutes to go out and seduce into the houseboat high campaign officials.
They were to linger about and attract the attention of mid-range Democratic staffers who would try to impress them with how important they were by saying, I'll watch tomorrow, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. We would get all of that.
And I said, Gordon, you've got to be kidding. And he really was very offended by my interruption. And taking that offense, he said, I want to assure the general these are the finest girls from Baltimore. At the end of Liddy's presentation, John Mitchell took kind of a long puff on his pipe, and a little cloud came up over his head and sort of sat there for a minute, and he said, Gordon, he said, I just don't think this is quite what we had in mind.
So I said to Gordon, I said, why don't you cut out all this other fluffy stuff that it really isn't what we're looking for and concentrate on the electronic surveillance?
I just said, gentlemen, I just don't think that the things that are being discussed here ought to be discussed in the office of the Attorney General of the United States.
Dean ran away, got in an elevator, and took off. He did not want me to start building him a new ass the way I did the last time. But I had Magruder, and I really ripped into Magruder saying, you know, what's going on here?
Liddy said, look, you've got this great friend and principal in the White House, Chuck Colson. He's got all kinds of influence. It's very important to me that this Gemstone project go forward because it's my career. My career, will you introduce me to Colson?
It was about 5:30, 6 o'clock one night, a typically frantic day in the White House. My secretary says, Howard Hunt is here, has a friend with him. I'd never met Gordon Liddy.
I started talking about our problem about getting a decision on the Gemstone plant. Colson did not want to hear about the Gemstone plant. He said, wait a minute, I don't want to hear any of this. What you need is a decision, correct? Yes. I said, fine. Picked up the phone, called Magruder.
I said, Jeb, these guys are in here. They can't get a decision. What are you guys going to do? Either give them a yes or a no. Don't leave them hanging.
What he did was clearly indicate to me he wanted, the president wanted, he always used the president, wanted to get this thing off the dime, get it going. So he wanted me to make a decision.
There was pressure from the White House, from me, and from the president to the committee to get their campaign intelligence activity going.
What Colson wanted me to do was to get off the stick, as he said, and get Liddy's project to bug Larry O'Brien's phone and so on off the ground and get it funded.
What's going to follow is one of the real bones of contention of Watergate, and it is, did John Mitchell, who by reputation was a very good lawyer, a bond lawyer, a honest guy, a guy that it was respected as one of the best attorney generals in the history of the country. You'll hear him talk about Henry Peterson really bragging about what a good attorney general John Mitchell was. But whether he approved this or not, and you know, his defense all along was he had nothing to cover up because he didn't approve this plan. And you have three people in the room, and one says that they did, and one says that he didn't, and the one that said he did had already been paying G. Gordon Liddy before they ever got there. And you know, you'll hear this laid out by the participants in the room, including Fred LaRue, from a documentary that the BBC did, and you're going to hear Jeff Shepard explain it too. And it's one of those that you've got to make up your mind about. I will say though that Jeb Magruder, later on, before he died, made some other claims that were very questionable that no one could prove and are not picked up on the tapes concerning the president himself. And so I don't see how, and you can come away having any trust in his credibility as compared to Fred LaRue or John Mitchell. But that's a personal opinion, and you'll have to make up your own mind.
The last item on the agenda was the Gemstone file. And the issue now was that we either had to approve it or it was going to be too late for us to do anything. So Mitchell, LaRue, and I talked about it.
I asked Jeb, I said, what the hell is this electronic surveillance business? He said, well, that's been in the mill a long time, and I'm getting a lot of pressure to get an answer on it.
The president wants it done. Haldeman seems to think it's very important. Colson's been on my back.
Mitchell read it. He looked at me and said, have you read this? I said, yes. He said, what do you think of it? I said, John, it's not worth the risk.
To me, it was a throwaway project. You know, give Liddy the $250,000 and let's get him off our back and satisfy the White House. And Mitchell finally said, okay, let's go with it, and signed off on the paper. Actually put his initials, as he always did, on the approval box to go ahead with the project.
I've reflected on this many times, and at the Key Biscayne meeting, or even after that, had I gone to Mitchell and said, John, this is crazy. I mean, this is a harebrained scheme. It's not going to do a damn thing but get us in trouble. let's put a stop to it. If you have to, go to the White House and back them off the damn thing. Had I done that and done it forcefully, John would have listened to me. And he would have done that, and this whole mess could have been avoided. It's one of the real regrets I have about Watergate.
So the meeting happens. It's 250,000. It's really reduced. It's
Three guys in the room. And there's a different story coming out of the room. Magruder says, Mitchell said, it's only 250. Let's give him the money and see what he can do with it. That Mitchell voiced approval. LaRue is in the room, and LaRue says, no. Mitchell said, this again, I don't want to see this anymore, and tossed it aside. Now, LaRue becomes a government witness. Mitchell says, I never approved it. He devotes half his time at the cover-up trial to saying, I never approved it. I had nothing to cover up. Magruder paid Liddy. Liddy's incurring debt because he's going on this plan and hadn't been approved. He didn't have any money. Magruder paid Gordon Liddy $37,000 before he went down to the Miami meeting because he thought, I think perhaps legitimately, that Gordon was going to beat him up if he didn't come across with any money.
When did the Miami meeting occur again?
March 30th, 1972.
When does the break-in of the Watergate occur?
June 17th.
So between March 30th, 1972, and June 17th, 1972, people are hired, money is paid, and who, other than G. Gordon Liddy, knows what the hell's going on?
Well, he brings his friend back, Howard Hunt, who's never become an employee but a consultant. He and Howard are the masterminds. They recruit the same Cubans. There's one Cuban different from the Fielding break-in, and they're going to get him to break into the Democratic National Committee headquarters. And then the stories divert again. There's a break-in on May 28th that's successful. And supposedly, they plant a bugging device on the telephone of Larry O'Brien, the DNC chairman, and a desk outside the office of a local official named Spencer Oliver. And his assistant is a lady by the name of Maxine Waters. And they bug her phone. And then the Larry O'Brien bug doesn't work. The Spencer Oliver phone is overheard by a gentleman across the street at the Howard Johnson's. These bugging devices have to have direct line of transmittal to pick up the bug. And he's hearing conversations. He's summarizing them. He's giving them to Creep.
Giving them to Gordon Liddy.
Yes, to Gordon Liddy.
And what is Gordon Liddy doing with the summaries of the, quote, intelligence, close quote? As
well,
President Nixon would later say, you're not going to learn anything
right
from Larry O'Brien and the DNC.
Yeah, but Larry O'Brien's bug doesn't work because he doesn't have line of sight to the hotel across the street. Only Spencer Oliver's works. There's some controversy over whether it really is Spencer Oliver's phone that's working. But the summaries go to Gordon. Gordon extracts stuff, gives it to Magruder. Magruder sends benefits of the campaign intelligence plan to an intermediary young lawyer named Gordon Strawn, who gives it either to Haldeman or Dean.
Is Gordon Strawn a White House employee or a committee to reelect employee?
Gordon Strawn is a White House employee on Haldeman's staff, whom Haldeman has assigned to be his go-between to the campaign.
Now, I've got to ask Jeff.
If Haldeman wants to know something, Haldeman calls the campaign. If the campaign wants to tell Haldeman something, they tell Gordon Strawn.
He had been set in as this campaign counsel, but with the responsibility for intelligence. And apparently he had a budget approved and was going to start moving on doing whatever he was going to do.
I was called in by Jeb Stuart Magruder to his office, and he said, can you get into the Watergate office building? We want you to wiretap Larry O'Brien's telephone and put in a room monitoring device so that conversations in there can be held. Anything that's available, we want it photographed. I took the decision, a dangerous gamble and risk, something I had told people I wouldn't do. And I recruited Mr. James McCord, who was the security chief of the committee to re-elect the president.
Once we got in, we found that Larry O'Brien's door was locked to his office. It adjoined the reception area there. And so there'd been so much time gone by, and there'd been, frankly, so much noise made in gaining entry that we just didn't really want to proceed to jimmy or break another lock.
I was distressed by them. They had nothing of value. I'm getting hairdressing appointments and things like that.
I talked to Mitchell, and I showed Mitchell what were the first fruits of Liddy's endeavor, and he looked through it rather quickly and agreed with me that these were worthless.
What they wanted was specifically, well, what's Larry O'Brien up to, and what's he doing, and what's he saying? We were going to have to go back in again and put in more devices and make sure that we got what they were looking for.
Mr. Magruder said, listen, Gordon, this is what I want. I want what Larry O'Brien has right here. And he struck his bottom desk drawer, which is where we kept what we had on the Democrats.
Well, I was telling Lydia, look, I want the real stuff, the information that's important, not this stuff that you've gotten for us. It has no meaning whatsoever to the campaign.
And he was thinking, I want everything photographed. And I said to myself, my Lord, what was supposed to be now a quick 5-minute in and out repair mission is a multi-hour photo recon mission.
When they asked us to go for the second operation, they told me to get up, I don't know, 50 roll of film. I multiplied 50 for 36, and I said, Jesus Christ, these people want a lot of pictures, you know.
Entry night was to be Friday night, June 16th, in anticipation of which the Miami team arrived in Washington that afternoon.
There was a man working in the back very, very late. I mean, he stayed and he stayed and he stayed. It's a Friday night. I mean, this was some dedicated Democrat. We thought he'd never go home. Finally, about 12:45, the word came from across the way at the lookout.
Jim said to whoever he was talking to on the phone, I think we can make a go. And with that, he said, Al, you're going to remain here. And he walked over to the bed and he took a walkie-talkie. He said, I want you to use this.
It was decided by Hunt and Liddy that McCord, who had access to the building, would go into the Watergate building and go down there and open the thing from the inside and put in tapes in the door.
We came to the back door and tried the handle, and the door was latched. Someone obviously had removed the tape, taken it off in that brief period of time.
I said, let's scratch this. And Liddy said, no, this is McCord's show. He's got to go through with it. And it's his fault that we're here. And besides, it's very important to my career that we do this.
You know, I felt like refusing, saying, no, this is far enough. But then I figured, you know, I was older, getting older. I wasn't a young kid anymore, and my personal feeling was these people don't think I'm scared, you know.
We were in contact by transceiver with our men inside the Watergate and also with the lookout, Mr. Baldwin, across the street.
We got a whispered radio thing from the guy saying, from Baldwin, said, are any of our guys dressed like hippies? And he said, no, they're not. And he said, well, there's like hippie looking guys, and they're on the seventh floor. And then he said, they're going down and they've got guns. And we tried to alert these the people that we had, the Cubans who were in there. And we kept saying, you know, like unit one to unit two, you know, one to unit two. And they had turned the gain down and they couldn't hear us. And then a substantial period of time after that, we got a whispered from them, they got us. And that was when we knew. And then, of course, the lights all went on, and Baldwin was reporting, you know, police cars and everything like that. And we knew that they had been apprehended, so Hunt and I took as much of the gear as we could, and we took all the stuff we could, and we walked down, walked out, walked past the police, got in our cars, and left. I went home. My wife woke up when I went into the bedroom, and I said something like, things didn't go well today. I think I'm going to have to go to jail. And I got in bed and went to sleep. Next day was Saturday. I knew that I had compromising material in my office over at the committee to reelect. And I went over and shredded everything, including, I think, 13 consecutively serialized $100 bills, which I put between two pieces of paper so that the people working in the office wouldn't see that I was shredding $100 bills and thinking I'd lost my mind.
Now the reception area to the Democratic headquarters lights up, the actual reception room, which I can see directly across from where I'm standing. And I know three individuals come into the reception area.
Out comes a fellow, a middle-aged man, one of the Miami men dressed in a suit.
They were more nervous than we were when they found us there. I mean, we were dressed up, and we were not the common burglar.
Here comes a second man out from behind the second desk, and he's dressed in a suit, and he doesn't look like a burglar either.
They come in waving guns and so forth. This is the police. What are you guys doing here?
They were wired. They were hyper. It didn't all add up. It didn't compute with them what was going on and who they had, except they knew we didn't belong there.
This is Randall Wallace, your host for Bridging the Political Gap. I want to thank you first for tuning in to our podcast and invite you to come to our website, randallwallace.com. There you can get a copy of our book, Always Vote Your Conscience, Don't Take It Personally, and Don't Fight the Same Old Battles Over and Over Again, with a lot of policy suggestions and things that I think everyone could embrace, an argument for why we need to be working together instead of fighting with each other. Also, you can take a look at the first 11 episodes of this podcast, which was a podcast documentary that looked at the World War II generation of bipartisan leadership that built the American century and the lessons we can learn from them to apply to today's situations. Again, thanks for tuning in to our podcast. And if you've enjoyed our show, please leave us a review at wherever you get your podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
I want your guesses to who knew what at this point. When the Watergate break-in occurs, does anybody know it's coming at the White House?
It is uncontroverted that no one at the White House knew in advance of the break-in, with the possible exception of John Dean. When the break-in occurred...
Not Chuck Colson.
Well, when the break-in occurred... The people at the White House, Haldeman and Ehrlichman, were terrified. It was a Colson operation. And they asked John Dean to look into it, and Dean said no, he wasn't involved.
So take me to that morning. The White House, the Washington Post has on the front page, I believe it's the front page, break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters.
Yeah. They're caught really early Saturday morning, June 17th. I don't know that story hits until Monday, but I could be wrong. But five or six guys are caught red-handed into the offices of the Democratic National Committee at the Watergate office building, and it's James McCord, who is the head of security for the committee to reelect the president, a retired CIA wire man who has bugging devices in his briefcase and four Cubans, one of whom has a notebook with Howard Hunt's phone number at the old EOB in the notebook. They have money on them, and they have a key to a room across the street at the, I think it was the Howard Johnson's at the time, hotel. And the FBI goes over and looks at the room, and they find a total of $5,000 of sequentially numbered, uncirculated $100 bills. That's what they have. The guys won't give their right names. They're arraigned, I believe, on Monday morning. I'm a little off on the dates. And the judge wants to know where McCord is employed, and McCord says the CIA. And young Bob Woodward is down assigned to cover that, or maybe it was Carl Bernstein. And that's the beginning, of the news that this could be connected to the committee to reelect. Committee puts out a press release. I think the press release was out on Sunday, so maybe this all occurred on Saturday morning and Sunday. It's denying any involvement. Before they knew what was going on. Then Dean is recalled from Manila in the Philippines. Get your tail back here. There's real trouble.
Who's called him?
Don't know, but it comes through the White House. Might have been Fred Fielding. I just don't know, but he's recalled.
When I heard about the break-in, I had been in Manila giving a speech for the Bureau of Narcotics at that point, or it's actually the Drug Enforcement Agency it becomes later. It was a graduation speech for a bunch of agents who had been trained by DEA. And I was crossing the date line. It's always a body twister, and I'd really flown out and was flying back. And I arrived in San Francisco, and I'm feeling really just jet-lagged badly. So I called Fred Fielding, my deputy, and I said, Fred, I'm going to stay in San Francisco and just rest today and come back tomorrow. This is on a Sunday night. And he said, well, I think you better come back. He said, there's been some activities here that you should know about. And Fred wouldn't say that if it wasn't serious. So I flew back, met with Fred, who lived right down the street from me in Old Town. And Fred tells me about this arrest at the DNC. And my immediate reaction is Colson. You know, I'm thinking back of Brookings. I'm thinking of all that. I say, you know, this sounds like Colson's gone crazy again. The next morning, it doesn't take me very long when Jeb Magruder calls me and said, it's Liddy. It's a disaster. His men, that Liddy says, have other footprints around or in trouble. He says, I can't talk to Liddy. You've got to talk to him. So I learn from Liddy, who tells me that the same men that he used when he's working at the White House doing the Ellsberg break-in are the people who are sitting in the D.C. jail.
He calls Gordon on Monday morning, and he says, Gordon, you know, because Gordon and Howard Hunt are nearby, but they're not caught. They're not arrested. Hunt panics, figures out where's the safest place to dump my evidence, figures it's his office at the old EOB because it's guarded, and goes into his office and divests himself of evidence.
Into a safe?
Well, it couldn't all fit in the safe, but in the safe in his office.
There is a safe in
Howard
Hunt's office.
There is a safe in Howard Hunt's office. Liddy and Hunt aren't arrested until later. Liddy's fired from the reelection. Dean knows. They have a meeting Tuesday night. The guys are arrested Saturday morning. There's a meeting in Mitchell's office, apartment Tuesday night, and it's John Dean and Jeb Magruder and Fred LaRue and maybe Bob Mardian and Mitchell, and they're trying to decide what to do because the guys...
Run through that again so someone doesn't have to reverse the tape. The break-in occurs...
Saturday. They're arrested Saturday.
News hits the White House. Dean is recalled from Manila. And he convenes a meeting, and who's in it?
Take a step back. They put out a press release on Sunday saying we're not involved. Dean arrives back home on Monday, calls Liddy, says, you know, Gordon. Gordon says, my people. Dean says, we have to meet. He doesn't want Liddy to come over to the EOB. There'll be a record of the meeting. So he meets him outside on 17th, and they go for what I call the walk in the park. They go down 17th, you know, where the ellipse is, that area. And Gordon says, they're my people, but they're good people. They won't, they'll hold steady. They won't say a word. But, I mean, you got to pay for their legal bills and stuff like that. And if you think, because I screwed up, and I did, there wasn't enough distance. I shouldn't have hired McCord. You know, he was working for Creep to do the bugging part. You just let me know, and I'll be standing on the street corner when you want a car to come by and hit me. So you want to take me out, I understand. I screwed up.
Does G. Gordon Liddy agree and John Dean agree that this meeting occurred and that offer was made?
Yes, without question. It's uncontroverted. Absolutely uncontroverted.
How did these people end up in the White House? Jeff Shepard. Richard Nixon may be the most brilliant mind, and I know this will be controversial, maybe the most brilliant mind ever to sit behind that desk. And he's got frickin' frack walking around having executed an illegal break-in.
Welcome back, Gordon. Lydia is here. Later, Swoosie Kurtz will be joining us. How has your family held up under the stress and trials of the Watergate and then the incarceration and now the book and the TV film and so forth? Now, it's been 10 years almost to the month, to the week here of the Watergate break-in. Is there...
Actually, we had a successful one, which anniversary is never celebrated. That actually is a few days ago.
Oh, so this would be the...
That's the one I celebrate. You see, you celebrate the other one. I'll celebrate the other one.
So, is there... Now, the one that... June, what was the date? The
17th of June, yeah.
Now, is there anything about this mess that you look back on and find amusing now?
Yeah, there were lots of things amusing. I remember it took us three times before we got in the first time successfully. And the second time that we unsuccessfully were in, Howard Hunt got trapped in a room, and the guards kept coming by swinging their flashlights. So, being the old OSS and CIA guy that he is, he hid in a closet. The closet happened to be a liquor closet. He was in there for 8 hours, and things got urgent. And Howard found a bottle of red, which was only one-third full. And by the end of the evening, let me just put it this way. If you ever go to the Watergate Hotel, under no circumstances order scotch. Never.
Go good with rat, wouldn't it?
Oddly enough, after the book came out, the Washington Star made a survey of the top chefs of Washington, all the haute cuisine, and they said, Liddy, there's one thing about Liddy is he does not know how properly to cook rat. And they gave their recipes and told what wine you should have with it and everything, and it's quite true. I really don't know.
This whole thing here, now when I introduced you, there was a smattering of some people booed a little bit, and I'm sure that this comes
well,
look,
John Sirica's children are everywhere. Some of them are undoubtedly out of nature.
But
lots of them.
And this afternoon, I was reading a little thing about you that said in other times, under other circumstances, you might have, in fact, been regarded as the ultimate soldier and even a hero, which I'm guessing is probably how you would like to be remembered. But objectively, if you can be objective, how do you see you being remembered in history by this country?
Well, I don't know that I'm going to be that much remembered. I think that as distance lends proportion, the historians are going to view the Watergate incident with decreasing importance. It was really just sort of a footnote. Mm.
And so you don't see an eternal place for yourself in the grand scheme of things?
No, I think the place for me in the grand scheme of things is the same as your place and the place of everybody here, and that is we shall provide a diet for the worms.
Ooh. My, what a cheerful note to end this on, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? One day we'll all be dust. Got that? We're just going to go. Interesting experience meeting you. I appreciate your time, sir. Gordon Liddy, ladies and gentlemen. And we're going to pause, but we'll be right back.